Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the March 11th, 2022 Friday edition of the Denver Post. My name is Tammy. Today I'll be reading the following main articles: 2020 Protests, DA to Drop Murder Case by Elise Schmelzer and Shelley Bradbury of the Denver Post, Bill Would Stabilize Rents in State's Mobile Home Parks by Sam Tabachnik and Alex Burness of the Denver Post, Lawmakers Advance Bill on Abortion Rights by Sasha Hindi of the Denver Post, and State Isn't Getting Enough Snow by Conrad Swanson, also of the Denver Post. And I'll be following up with miscellaneous articles. And our lead story, 2020 Protests, DA to Drop Murder Case, Unlicensed Guard Fatally Shot Man Claimed Self-Defense by Elise Schmelzer and Shelley Bradbury. Prosecutors plan to drop the murder charge filed against an unlicensed security guard who shot a man in 2020 after dueling rallies downtown because they don't believe they can overcome the security guard's claim that he acted in self-defense. Matthew Doloff, 32, shot and killed Lee Keltner, 49, on October 10, 2020, during a confrontation between the pair toward the end of opposing political rallies in Denver's Civic Center. One demonstration featured conservative Patriot rally attendees. The group was met by left-leaning counter-protesters. Doloff's attorney, Doug Richards, said prosecutors with the Denver District Attorney's Office told him they intend to dismiss the second-degree murder case at the pretrial conference scheduled for March 21st. A jury trial was set to begin April 12th. I'm just really happy for Matt and his family that the DA finally realized what we'd known all along, Richards said. A spokeswoman for the district attorney on Thursday confirmed that prosecutors plan to dismiss the murder charge because they cannot overcome Doloff's statement that he acted in self-defense. Doloff had not been charged with anything else in connection with the fatal shooting. Prosecutors informed Keltner's family of their decision Thursday, spokeswoman Carolyn Tyler said in an email. In line with our ethical obligations, we cannot overcome the legal justifications of self-defense or defense of others, Tyler said. We are not able to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. Under Colorado law, a person can use deadly force in self-defense only if that person reasonably thinks using less force won't be sufficient, and the person reasonably believes he or someone else faces an immediate threat of being killed or seriously hurt. There is no duty to retreat under state law, but the action taken in self-defense generally must be proportionate to the attack, experts have said. A member of Keltner's family declined to comment about the district attorney's decision Thursday. On the day of the rallies, the two sides were kept apart by police for much of the day until the events began to wind down and protesters started to leave. It was then that Keltner and a handful of others began arguing with counter-protesters near the Denver Art Museum. Doloff was working as a security guard for Denver television station 9 News at the time and accompanied a 9 News producer as the producer filmed the argument on his cell phone. The fatal encounter, which was captured by a Denver Post photographer, began when Keltner told the producer to put the camera away and said he was going to expletive him up. Doloff stepped between the two and physically blocked Keltner, who was holding a can of bear spray. Keltner slapped Doloff in the face. Doloff pulled a gun from his belt and shot Keltner as Keltner discharged the bear spray. Doloff was arrested immediately and later charged with second-degree murder. He said he acted in self-defense. He was not licensed to work as an armed security guard in Denver at the time. Keltner, who died at the scene, was a respected hat maker and Navy veteran who held conservative beliefs and was, toward the end of his life, drawn to political action. Nine News declined to comment. Our next story, legislature, bill would stabilize rents in state's mobile home parks, by Sam Tabachnik and Alex Burness. Heather Malone and her family were priced out of the apartment market in Golden 10 years ago, so they moved into a mobile home park. Rent in the park, Golden Hills, was affordable. That allowed Malone to stay close to work, to keep her kids in the schools they loved, and near the hiking trails they enjoyed on the weekends. Everything changed last year when a California company bought Golden Hills. Malone soon learned that her rent would increase to $796 a month from $550, a 45% leap. Such a hike would be a problem for most renters, but mobile homeowners face a unique dilemma. They own the structure, but not the land, which means the solution to skyrocketing rent is not as simple as just moving somewhere else. Now Malone is forced to think about getting another job, perhaps at a grocery store, to get extra cash and a discount on food. It would mean seeing her children less. Another rent increase, even a small one, could mean her family will need to go elsewhere. All the stress that comes with struggling financially, Malone said, we're feeling it so hard right now. Malone's experience in Golden has become increasingly common throughout Colorado as corporations gobble up more mobile home parks and increase rents at rates that many cannot stomach. It's these stories that have prompted Colorado Democrats in the Capitol to bring a bill that includes statewide rent stabilization for mobile home parks, a radical move for a legislature that just 3 years ago killed a bill that would have allowed local governments to cap rent increases. But unsubsidized affordable housing is going extinct in Colorado, and lawmakers feel this year's policy is necessary to preserve the largest source of naturally occurring affordability in the state. These situations are real, said State Representative Andrew Bosnecker, the Fort Collins Democrat championing the bill. For residents, this is a tangible, lived experience that impacts their ability to know they'll be safely housed. Most of these folks buy these mobile homes thinking they'll spend the rest of their days there. The bill, HB 22-1287, includes a slew of other protections for mobile home owners and amounts to a new Bill of Rights for those residents. It would make it easier for them to purchase their parks, compel landlords to compensate residents if they decide to redevelop a park for other uses, and for the first time, give the Attorney General authority to enforce protections. Critics warn heavy-handed regulation could produce unintended consequences, causing park owners to sell their properties or kick out tenants to build more lucrative apartment buildings. Industry experts say the legislation, as drafted, would vault Colorado into the upper tier of states trying to preserve mobile home parks as an affordable option during a nationwide housing crisis. Bills like this could strengthen, could support, and grow affordable housing stock for decades, said Esther Sullivan, an assistant professor of sociology at the University of Colorado Denver, who has conducted extensive research on mobile home residents and parks in the United States. This is that kind of opportunity, Sullivan said. The bill is 54 pages long, but much of the attention and debate around it centers on one proposal, statewide rent stabilization, that would cover the more than 700 mobile home parks and 46,000 mobile homes in Colorado. This would be a radical new restriction on mobile home park landlords, some mom-and-pop owners, but also increasingly national corporations and private equity giants. The proposed legislation would prohibit a landlord from increasing rent on a mobile home lot by an amount that exceeds the greater of inflation or 3 percentage points in any 12-month period. Currently, park owners can raise rent only once per year, but have no restrictions on how much they can charge. Colorado would not be the first place to see rent stabilization for mobile homes. These statutes exist in nearly 100 California cities and counties, but a statewide measure is exceedingly rare in the U.S. Oregon, in 2019, became the first to implement statewide rent control, but that law includes all housing, not just mobile home communities. Democrats control both chambers of the Colorado legislature and decide what passes and fails. Some version of this bill is nearly assured to pass, but the big question is whether its more controversial and impactful provisions, capping rent increases, namely, will survive a coming onslaught of proposed amendments. The Speaker of the House, Denver Democrat Alec Garnett, stopped short of endorsing rent stabilization when asked about it Tuesday, although he did commend Bosnecker's work on the issue. The bill doesn't appear to be priority legislation in the Senate, where, as of this writing, it has no lead sponsor. Fort Collins Democrat Joanne Ginnall has been set to lead the bill through the Senate, but on Tuesday she told the Denver Post she had a little thinking to do and that she was not thrilled with some aspects. By Wednesday, her name was removed from the bill. She claimed she's busy with two other things and doesn't have the capacity to shepherd HB 22-1287. But proponents won't be willing to compromise much on rent stabilization as the bill moves through the Capitol. It is at the heart of this policy because housing advocates continually find soaring rent costs to be the biggest issue facing residents. David Villot, a housing attorney with the Colorado Poverty Law Project, said he has yet to speak to a single resident in Colorado who hasn't faced issues with rent. Rent stabilization is huge, he said. It's revolutionary in Colorado. There's a big difference between mobile home owners and, say, apartment renters. Mobile home owners invest lots of money into their properties, not just through purchase, but through upgrades and maintenance, which makes relocation especially unappealing. Despite the name, mobile homes are rarely actually mobile. That's what gives park owners the latitude to continually increase rent, something the creators of Colorado's Mobile Home University preach as one of their core teachings. Frank Rolfe, who runs the boot camp for prospective mobile home park buyers, has likened it to a Waffle House where customers are chained to their booths. Given the equity and lack of mobility that these mobile homeowners have, it makes sense to me that there need to be protections in place so that mobile homeowners won't lose their property interest, said Deborah Cantrell, a University of Colorado law professor who participated in stakeholder conversations surrounding the bill. But for those working in mobile home brokerage and an industry group representing park owners, argue that the bill doesn't address the root causes of the affordable housing crisis and could lead to landlords taking their business elsewhere. The housing lobby hailed the defeat of Colorado's 2019 rent control bill as a tremendous victory, and they'll fight again this time. We're strongly opposed to rent control, said Tawny Payton, executive director of the Rocky Mountain Home Association. We feel it is not good policy, and additionally, we feel it's unsound economically. This stifles creation for affordable housing. The proposed legislation seems to be discriminatory, she said, as it singles out one type of property owner. The organization is consulting with its attorneys as it decides whether to challenge portions of the bill in court. John Shea, a manufactured home broker in Colorado, sees park owners washing their hands of their investments and looking for new opportunities if this bill becomes law. The incentive structure will shift, he said. I think what's going to happen is community owners will say, this land that I own is worth more as an apartment building or office, Shea said. It will lead to communities being shut down and redeveloped. HB 22-1287 contains scores of other protections for mobile home owners. One of the main focuses of the bill is helping give mobile home owners a better shot at purchasing their parks when they go on sale. The Opportunity to Purchase Clause came into effect in 2020, but only three groups of residents in Boulder, Durango, and Leadville have successfully bought their parks under the new law. Why? It's extremely difficult to secure millions in funding and organize a resident co-op in just 90 days, advocates and mobile home residents have said. Plus, they argue some owners are negotiating in bad faith and seemingly make deals before alerting residents that their park would be for sale. The proposed legislation would provide a right of first refusal for a public entity, such as a county or city or a housing authority, working with a resident-owned community group. That means an owner selling a park would have to give the public entity first crack at making an offer before they take a deal with someone else. The bill would also double the amount of time, from 90 to 180 days, that residents have to organize and make an offer. With a right of first refusal, it's a much heftier ability to step in and preserve affordable housing, said Michael Pierce, a mobile home owner in Boulder, who worked with fellow residents to buy their Sands Sushi Park last year. It doesn't allow what we've been experiencing, which is landlords saying no without a discernible reason. Other notable pieces of the legislation include requiring landlords who change the use of the land where a mobile home park sits to compensate residents who would be displaced. Experts say it can cost more than $10,000 to move a mobile home, and some are too old to move at all. The bill would also allow the Colorado Attorney General to investigate and enforce statutory provisions providing protections for mobile home owners, allow local governments or nonprofits, in addition to residents, to file complaints with Colorado's Mobile Home Oversight Program, allow regulators to take immediate action in response to a complaint that will cause immediate harm to mobile home owners, clarify language and obligations regarding good faith negotiations over potential sales, run alongside a companion bill, not yet introduced, to create a $50 million fund to help residents buy mobile home parks. For people such as Heather Malone, this legislation could be the difference between staying in the home they love, in the community they love, and being pushed out farther to the fringes. There are plenty of opportunities for real estate investors to make a nice profit in Colorado, but that profit should not come at the expense of the most marginalized populations, of actual people who live actual lives in the places they're investing in, she said. Turning to more legislative news, lawmakers advance bill on abortion rights. Hearing lasts almost 14 hours before party line vote, by Saja Hindi. Nearly 14 hours after the hearing on the bill to enshrine abortion rights into state law began, Colorado lawmakers advanced the measure out of its first committee early Thursday morning. Lawmakers approved HB 22-1279 on a party line vote of 7-4 without changes just before 4 a.m. as it moves toward a vote by the full House. The proposed law, dubbed the Reproductive Health Equity Act, is sponsored by the majority of Colorado's Democratic representatives and senators. It's their response to attempts in other states to restrict access to abortion and the possibility of the U.S. Supreme Court overturning Roe v. Wade. Although Colorado doesn't have gestational restrictions on abortions in state law, it doesn't have anything guaranteeing access to them either. This bill would do that for abortions and other reproductive care before and after pregnancy, and it would ban local and state governments from interfering in that care. It would also prevent a fertilized egg, embryo, or fetus from having independent rights under state law. What is happening now in Colorado will simply be solidified in law should this bill pass, House Majority Leader Danea Esgar, a Pueblo Democrat, told committee members. We're not making new laws. We are not making new places of access. We are simply saying we are protecting the choice and being proactive to protect a person's choice when it comes to pregnancy. Committee members listened to almost 13 hours of testimony from hundreds of proponents and opponents of the bill during the sometimes raucous hearing that also included prayers, singing poetry, and even a request that someone be removed for shouting near the beginning of the hearing. House Health and Insurance Committee Leader Susan Lontine, a Denver Democrat, and Representative Chris Kennedy, a Lakewood Democrat, repeatedly warned members of the crowd to hold their applause and comments in response to people testifying. And as the hours wore on, so too did the weariness from the audience that included crying babies. Healthcare professionals, people who have had abortions, advocates, and community members appealed to lawmakers, with much of the discussion centered around the fundamental disagreement of whether abortion should be legal and whether the rights of a woman should be held higher than those of a potential future child. GOP lawmakers Representatives Mark Baisley of Colorado Springs, Mary Bradfield of Colorado Springs, Patrick Neville of Castle Rock, and Stephanie Luck of Penrose all voted against the bill. I'm in great fear that we are attempting to remove the rights of one segment of humanity by statute, Baisley said, and I don't think we have the right, the position. I kind of hope that no legislature does. Neville and opponents of the bill also raised concerns that the bill would remove the requirements in the 2003 Colorado Parental Notification Act, which mandates healthcare providers notify parents or guardians of scheduled abortion procedures for minors. Democratic sponsors pledged to work with Republicans as the bill moved through the legislature process to ensure it was clear that nothing in the bill would change that. Dr. Nancy Fang, an OBGYN, was among the healthcare providers who spoke in favor of the bill, telling a story of a patient from Texas who had her water break at 4.5 months pregnant. Knowing the devastating odds of having her baby pass away or having a life-threatening infection herself, she was told her only option was to wait until she became septic or went into labor, Fang said. She had to leave that hospital to fly to Denver and have a life-saving abortion. She's okay now, but this is why Colorado must remain a place where abortion remains accessible, because patients count on us to help them in their worst moments. This type of legislation would be especially impactful for communities of color, speakers in favor of the bill at the hearing stressed, and it would give pregnant women a choice about what to do with their bodies, particularly as complications arise. Some speakers told committee members how having that choice made a difference in their own lives. This bill will protect our communities from future attacks on our rights, and whatever our rights are, and whenever our rights are attacked, it's marginalized communities that experience the worst of the consequences, said Victoria Dedet, Soul to Soul Sisters Vote Coordinator and Senior Advocacy Manager for New Era Colorado. Black women know this all too well, which is why we have spent centuries fighting for the basic right to control our bodies, be able to plan our futures, and live safe and healthy lives. Opponents of the bill, however, argued that it goes too far and is too broad, as committee member Luck argued. Some women who regretted having abortions shared their experiences, with some speakers invoking their Christian beliefs and teachings. Alan Parker, a former attorney who worked to overturn Roe v. Wade and president of the Justice Foundation, said he represents thousands of women who've been injured by abortion. This bill would be detrimental to the health and safety of women in Colorado, and Colorado has the answer to the abortion wars, he said, noting the psychological toll abortions can take. It's your safe haven law, under which any woman can safely surrender her baby to a hospital or fire station within 3 days of birth, at no cost, and be free of the burden of child care, he said. Democrats have the votes to pass the legislation this year, even without Republican support. Still, a future legislature could overturn the law, so a coalition of abortion rights advocates plans to work on a ballot measure for 2024, asking voters to approve access to abortion in the Colorado Constitution. State isn't getting enough snow. Levels won't help rivers. Reservoirs in Colorado recover from drought, by Conrad Swanson. For months, Colorado's climatologists said the state would need consistent, above-average snowfall this winter to recharge the state's dry soils, rivers, and reservoirs. It didn't happen. Instead, the more fortunate areas of the state saw an average amount of snowpack, which might be enough to moisten the parched ground and maybe refill some of Colorado's smaller reservoirs, Becky Bollinger of the Colorado Climate Center said. For a glimpse of the bigger picture across the American West, Mollinger, also a climatologist with the Colorado State University, pointed to Lake Powell in Utah and Arizona, which is at a record low. "We're not going to recover," she said. "A drought like the one enveloping the West, which has lasted for 2 decades, needs much more than a single winter of average snowfall to bounce back," Bollinger said. Winter snowfall started off strong in late December and early January, but it lost momentum in the following weeks. Snowpack data shows that accumulation around Gunnison and Ouray sits at 109% of normal levels, down from 148% in early January. Snowpack around Durango sits at 101% of normal, down from 137%. Levels around Aspen and Glenwood Springs are 100% of normal, down from 124% in early January, and the area around Steamboat Springs sits at 88%, down from 115%, according to the data collected by the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Natural Resources Conservation Service. Snowpack around Denver sits at 96%, down from 114%. A few more weeks remain until Colorado hits its typical snowpack peak in early April, Bollinger said. But with current weather trends, seeing larger snowstorms that could bump snowpack well above average seems increasingly unlikely. If current snowpack levels remain constant, Colorado likely will see a bit more water in its rivers and streams, Bollinger said. The good news is that when you do have near-average peak snowpack, you're going to get a decent bump up, even if you don't get back to your normal levels, Bollinger said. To see how much of a bump Colorado will get, Bollinger said she will keep an eye on spring temperatures. If all the snow melts at once, dry soils won't have a chance to absorb needed moisture, she said. A good, drawn-out spring melt can buffer against wildfires and drier summers, Bollinger said. The area of biggest concern for the summer right now is the Eastern Plains, she added. And in some local briefs, woman shot in road rage incident. A woman was wounded in a road rage incident that escalated into a shooting Thursday morning in Commerce City. Police found the woman suffering from a gunshot wound about 9 a.m. in an alley in the 6200 block of Kearney Street, according to a news release from the Commerce City Police Department. The woman was transported to a hospital. Investigators believe the woman was involved in a road rage incident with another woman that began elsewhere. The incident ended when the women's two vehicles crashed in the 6200 block of Kearney Street. Both drivers exited their vehicles and a female suspect shot the victim, according to the news release. The female suspect fled from the scene. On Thursday afternoon, police identified the suspect as 24-year-old Destiny Edwards, who is also known as Destiny Salazar. She is wanted on suspicion of attempted murder and is considered armed and dangerous. Anyone with information on the whereabouts of Edwards is asked to call police at 303-289-3626, or they can call Metro Denver Crime Stoppers at 720-913-7867. And that was written by Elise Schmelzer and Kieran Nicholson of the Denver Post. And in another brief written by Kieran Nicholson, school locked down after report of armed person. A report of a person armed with a rifle prompted a lockdown at Rock Canyon High School on Thursday morning, according to the Douglas County Sheriff's Office. The report was made at 9:22 a.m. about someone who was possibly armed with what appeared to be a rifle in the school's parking lot, according to a news release. The school in Highlands Ranch was put on lockdown. Deputies contacted a 17-year-old student outside the school, and a water pellet gun was recovered, the release said. The student's parents have been notified and are cooperating with an investigation. Law bans American Indian mascots, so 11 Colorado schools change nickname, by John Aguilar of the Denver Post. 11 Colorado schools from the metro area to the Eastern Plains to the San Luis Valley were deemed Thursday to be in compliance with a 2021 state law that prohibits public schools from using American Indians as mascots. The Colorado Commission of Indian Affairs, led by Lieutenant Governor Diane Primavera, debated the status of 23 schools across 13 school districts that feature names and mascots, such as Warriors, Braves, and Indians, which are considered culturally disrespectful. The Sanford School District, 25 miles south of Alamosa, is changing its mascot to the Thundering Mustangs from the Indians. Frederick High School north of Denver changed the name of its mascot from the Warriors to the Golden Eagles last fall. They were removed from the noncompliance list Thursday. That leaves 12 schools in the state, including Lamar High School, the Savages, and Arikari Elementary School, the Indians, still out of compliance with SB 21-116, which was signed into law last summer. They have until June 1st to get right with the law or face a monthly $25,000 fine. Last month, the Yuma School District Board of Education voted unanimously to drop the name Indians as its mascot, but it was unable to come up with a substitute, opting to simply use Yuma for all sports team monikers. Despite that move, the commission on Thursday did not take the Eastern Plains District off of the noncompliance list. The commission also kept three schools in the Elbert County School District, southeast of Denver, on the list, despite the district saying it has a letter from the Kiowa tribe, giving its blessing to the use of the Indian name. A tribe can give its approval for schools to use Native American imagery for their mascots if it feels the partnership would foster education, goodwill, and cultural understanding. Littleton Public Schools reached an agreement with the Arapaho Nation in 1993 to continue using its Arapaho Warrior moniker. Strasburg School District did the same with the representatives of the Northern Arapaho Tribe. The schools removed from the list on Thursday were Campo Elementary School, Campo Junior and Senior High School, Community Prep School in Colorado Springs, Central High School in the Mesa Valley School District, Centennial Middle School in the Montrose County School District, Avondale Elementary School in the Pueblo County Rural 70 School District, Sanford Elementary School, Sanford Junior and Senior High School, Frederick High School in the St. Vrain Valley School District, Weldon Valley PK through 6, and Weldon Valley Junior Senior High School. The schools remaining on the list are Arikari Elementary School, Arikari Undivided High School, Kiowa Elementary School, Kiowa Middle School, Kiowa High School, Lamar High School, Montrose's Johnson Elementary School, and Montrose High School, Montrose Valley School in Sawatch, and Yuma's Kenneth P. Morris Elementary School, Yuma Middle School, and Yuma High School. Duplicating Federal Effort, Colorado, to Stop Mailing Free COVID-19 Test by Meg Wingerter. If you've been meaning to order at-home COVID-19 tests from the state, you only have until the end of Tuesday to get it done before Colorado shuts down the program. Scott Bookman, the state's COVID-19 incident commander, said Colorado is going to redirect those resources because of a similar program now existing at the federal level. The state estimated residents have ordered more than 2.5 million of the free tests since September. We are proud of this groundbreaking program and to have been able to get millions of tests into the hands of Coloradans in the comfort of their own homes, he said in a news release. The federal program, launched in January through the Postal Service, allows each household to order four tests twice, although people who live in apartments have reported difficulty completing an order. The state program allowed residents to order kits containing eight tests once a month, but it didn't limit how many times they could place an order. The state, however, will continue to distribute the free test for pickup at Colorado libraries and other locations, a program that began late last month. The Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment urged anyone with symptoms who tested negative with an at-home kit to get a test looking for the virus's genetic material to confirm that before coming out of isolation. People who test positive with an at-home kit don't need another test to confirm the results, but are encouraged to report their case at covidrapidtests.colorado.gov. To order from the state program, you can visit covidathometesting.colorado.gov. For the federal program, go to covidtests.gov or call 800-232-0233. 16-year-old killed, four suspects arrested for fatal shooting at hotel in Aurora. Three others also shot. Most involved were juveniles, by Kieran Nicholson. A 16-year-old was killed Wednesday night at an Aurora hotel, and four suspects, including three juveniles, have been arrested in the case. The shooting happened at 7:05 p.m. at the Quality Inn, 3300 Uray Street, near the swimming pool area, according to police. The teen victim was pronounced dead at the scene. Three others were wounded. Officers found two women, ages 20 and 19, who had been shot, and they were taken to a hospital with serious wounds, police said. A fourth person shot at the hotel, self-transported to a hospital. Shortly after the shootings at the hotel, a 911 call was made about a person being shot at Chambers and East Smith Roads, police said. Officers contacted three juveniles and an 18-year-old man who was suffering from a gunshot wound. The man was taken to a hospital for treatment. Officers determined that the three juveniles and the man who was shot were suspects in the hotel shooting, police said. The juveniles were taken into custody Wednesday night, and the man who was shot was held after he was released from the hospital on Thursday afternoon. All four suspects are being investigated for first-degree murder, police said. The juveniles were not identified Thursday. The 18-year-old suspect who was shot is Rafael Bergeron Martinez of Westminster. I want to highlight the exceptional teamwork that these arrests represent, said Aurora Chief Vanessa Wilson in a news release. Our officers and detectives from patrol, the gang unit, and the major crimes homicide unit worked quickly to apprehend the suspects. District Attorney Brian Mason noted that the victim killed at the hotel was a teen, and that three of the four suspects are teens and the fourth a young adult. The victims at the hotel were also young adults. Last night, our community was, once again, shaken by the news of gun violence involving young people, Mason said in the release. A 16-year-old is dead, and several others are hurt as a result of this mass shooting. This is yet another horrific case of a teen losing their life because too many young people have easy and unsupervised access to firearms. The Adams County Coroner's Office will release the deceased victim's name after positive identification and family notification. Anyone with information on the shooting or on the suspects is asked to call Metro Denver Crime Stoppers at 720-913-7867. CU to dismantle investments in Russia, Dateline Boulder. The University of Colorado recently announced its decision to withdraw from investments in Russian companies after Governor Jared Polis urged higher education institutions to find ways to divest from Russian state-owned assets as the crisis in Ukraine continues. In addition, at least one Boulder faculty member has ended a research partnership with a Russian institute that expressed support for the country's invasion of Ukraine. Polis wrote a letter last week asking higher education institutions to ensure money does not support the Russian government. CU has less than 0.1% of its $2.6 billion investment pool in publicly traded Russian companies, the release said. The investments are through the Four Campus Systems Foundation and Treasury Pool. The university also has about $3.5 million invested in mutual funds that have equity holdings in Russia, the release said. CU has requested to exit the holdings as early as possible. No faculty members at any of CU's four campuses are conducting research funded by Russian entities, the release said. Sarah Wilson-Soki, associate professor with CU's Department of Political Science, said she recently ended her affiliation as an associate fellow with the research center at the Higher School of Economics in Moscow after the school signed a letter supporting Russia's action against Ukraine. Douglas County Sheriff seeks help from public to identify arson suspects. The Douglas County Sheriff's Office is asking for the public's help in identifying two people suspected of starting a fire at a haunted house in Parker. The Sheriff's Office released surveillance images Tuesday of a pair who entered the Flat Acres Farm haunted house, Fright Acres, at 1:23 a.m. on October 25th, just before a large fire broke out at the attraction at 11321 Dransfeld Road. South Metro Fire Rescue and deputies responded to the scene, and it took more than 6 hours to extinguish the blaze, which had spread to a corn maze and a pumpkin patch. Anyone with information about the incident or suspects is asked to call Metro Denver Crime Stoppers. That number again, 720-913-7867. And school district receives EPA grant. The Boulder Valley School District is receiving a $120,000 grant to replace six diesel school buses with newer, low-emission buses. The district is one of four in Colorado receiving $540,000 in rebates to support the replacement of 27 diesel buses with low-emission buses through the agency's Diesel Emissions Reduction Act program, according to a news release. Recipients will use the funds to replace old diesel school buses in their fleets with new electric, diesel, gasoline, propane, or compressed natural gas school buses meeting current emission standards. Boulder Valley plans to use the money to replace older buses, mostly from the early 1990s, with newer, cleaner gasoline buses. Panel advances security bill for elected officials by James Anderson of the Associated Press. Spurred by an increase in threats against public servants, a legislative panel has advanced a bill that would provide extra security to the state's chief elections officer and other statewide elected officials. The bill would allow the state patrol to assign at least one officer to the Secretary of State, the Attorney General, and the state treasurer, up to 80 hours per week upon request, with additional security resources available if the chief of the patrol deems it's warranted. State lawmakers may request security under procedures to be developed by legislative leadership and the state patrol, which is entrusted with security at the Capitol and surrounding state government offices. Senator Faith Winter, a Democrat, and Kevin Priola, a Republican, said their measure is designed to respond to thousands of threats against Democratic Secretary of State Gina Griswold, who has become a nationwide advocate for secure elections and a prominent debunker of claims that the 2020 presidential election was stolen from President Donald Trump. Women, especially Black, Indigenous, and women of color, as well as transgender women, are dissuaded more and more from seeking public office because they worry about their own and their family's safety in an increasingly vitriolic political environment, Winter and Priola told the Senate, State Veterans and Military Affairs Committee on Tuesday. I see this as a direct threat to our democracy, Winter said. We've seen increased threats against all 100 of us, not just one side, she said, referring to the legislature. The Secretary of State, Attorney General, and Treasurer must request security for public appearances or for travel through the governor's office. An original version of the bill gave discretion to the State Patrol to decide the merits of each request. A version that passed on a party line 3-2 vote Tuesday would ensure the 80 hours of protection and allow the patrol chief to decide if more is warranted. Legislative economists estimated about $825,000 would be needed to pay for the added security under the original bill. The Secretary of State's office is living in a threat environment unlike any we've seen, Griswold testified. She noted that the Department of Homeland Security issued a bulletin in January warning of the potential of violence by political extremists relating to election fraud conspiracies heading into the 2022 midterm elections and beyond. The bill advances to the Senate Appropriations Committee. Mesa County elections clerk appears in court by the Associated Press, Dateline Grand Junction. The Mesa County elections clerk, who was jailed after being accused of plotting to breach voting system technology that is used across the U.S., made her first court appearance by video Thursday. Clerk Tina Peters made no comment during the brief hearing before District Judge Matthew Barrett as she watched remotely from the county jail. Peters surrendered to authorities Wednesday after a grand jury indictment, alleging she was part of a deceptive scheme to breach state election systems. The judge reduced Peters' bail from $500,000 to $25,000, but ordered her to surrender her passport and not to leave Colorado pending her next court date on May 24th. He did tell Peters' attorneys he would consider a request to allow Peters to travel to North Carolina to attend the funeral of her father, who, according to attorneys, passed away overnight. Peters wore a yellow jail shirt and watched patiently during the hearing. The judge ordered her not to have any contact with elections employees, witnesses in the case, or a co-defendant, Belinda Knisley, deputy county clerk. Peters has called the charges against her a politically motivated attempt to sabotage her intent to run for Colorado Secretary of State this year. Knisley also has denied wrongdoing. The judge ordered her bail set at $10,000, and she also was ordered to avoid contact with Peters, the elections office, and witnesses in the case. Peters is a Republican elected in 2018 who repeatedly has appeared with supporters of former President Donald Trump, who made claims that the 2020 presidential election was stolen. She faces 7 felony and 3 misdemeanor counts, including attempting to influence a public servant. And there are a number of obituaries in today's paper, so I will read the basics from them. Joseph Abel, born on February 16, 1934, and died on February 1, 2022. Joseph Joe Markwell Abel, 87, of Denver, died on February 1, 2022. He was a longtime petroleum engineer and business person. Joe will be remembered for his dedication and loving care for his wife, Bonnie, as she had a long struggle with Alzheimer's disease. A memorial service will be held at Horan and McConaughey Chapel on South Colorado Boulevard in Denver on March 14th at 12:30 p.m. You can see the full obituary at horancares.com. Jeanette Nesbitt Burns. Jean passed away at the age of 100 on March 8, 2022. She was born in Salt Lake City, Utah on May 26, 1921. She married Robert Burns in 1947, and the couple had 3 sons. After her husband died in an auto accident in 1969, she began her career at Aspen Airways, where she stayed until she retired in 1986. Jean is survived by sons Greg, Randy, and Brad, granddaughters Corey, Lindsay, Casey, and Lauren, great-grandsons Hudson, Caleb, Austin, Colby, and Declan, and great-granddaughter Nicolette. George Howard Cooper, a retired postal worker who lived in Montbello, passed away February 27th in Aurora at 92. He was born August 11th, 1929. His marriage to Maxine Mosby ended in divorce. He is survived by sons Clifford of Landover Hills, Maryland, and Kenneth of Boston, daughters Cheryl Traylor and Vernice Vafides, both of Denver, brother Jack of Pacoima, California, and sister Beverly Maribel of Monrovia, California. 3 granddaughters and 6 great-grandchildren. He was predeceased by son Ronald, brothers Kenneth and Jerry, and sisters Barbara Zeely and Betty King. A graveside service will be held Friday, March 11th at 1:30 p.m. at Fairmount Cemetery. Mary Jo Hamilton, born December 18, 1941, and died March 8, 2022. She is survived by her loving son Bradley Lopata, sister-in-law Kay Hamilton, niece Debbie Sear, and nephew Jeff Hamilton. Hubert J. Hill of Golden. Visitation is Monday, March 14th at 10:30 a.m. with services at 11:30 a.m. at the chapel at Ellis Family to Golden Cemetery. Obituary and tribute wall is at www.ellisfamilyservices.com. Juanita Nita Horner was born in Denver in 1933 to Harold and Virginia Watson. She died on March 8, 2022. She married Jack M. Horner in 1955 and worked in the fashion industry. Nita is survived by daughter Lisa Pobrislow, son Randy Horner, 3 granddaughters, 3 great-granddaughters, and 1 great-grandson. A private family service will be held, donations to charity of choice. Vernon A. Bud Isaacs passed away unexpectedly on February 22, 2022. Bud, who recently celebrated his 80th birthday, had worked in the oil and gas business and was a decorated veteran with the 101st Airborne. He is survived by his wife of 54 years, Kay, his children Kimberly, Scott, and Chad, his grandchildren Chelsea, Haley, Riley, Anton, and Peyton. Bud's memorial service will be Tuesday, March 15th at 2 p.m. at Cherry Creek Presbyterian Church on Bellevue Avenue in Greenwood Village. A reception will follow. In lieu of flowers, please consider a donation to the Upper Colorado River Alliance or a charity of your choice. Christine Salazar, born December 15, 1941, and died March 3, 2022. She is survived by her husband of 60 years, Bernie Salazar, and daughters, Christine Hoagland and Elizabeth Salazar Diaz. Also survived by Stephen Salazar and her pet, Caesar. She had 4 grandchildren, 9 great-grandchildren, and 1 great-granddaughter. Viewing will be Monday, March 14th from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m., 7 p.m. Rosary, followed by services on Tuesday, March 15th. Final viewing from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. with a 1 p.m. Mass. There will be a procession to follow from the funeral home to Mount Olivet Cemetery. After the interment, services will conclude. Mary Helen Solomon, Ph.D., born November 13, 1926, and died February 28, 2022. Her first husband was Gene Hawes, and her second husband was Delbert Solomon, whom she married in December 1997. She is survived by daughters Mary Persak and Cynthia Savage, foster son Dr. Ben Bongutu, older brother Homer Craybill, and several grandchildren and five great-grandchildren. A celebration of Mary Helen's life will be held on March 12th at 2 p.m. in the Smith Chapel at the Covenant Village in Westminster. Donations can be made to Covenant Benevolent Fund in care of Covenant Living Colorado, 9153 Yarrow Street, Westminster, Colorado, 80021. And our final story for the day, Scotland apologizes for witchcraft persecution. The persecution began in the 1500s and lasted almost two centuries. Nearly 4,000 people were accused of witchcraft, a vast majority of them women. They were arrested, brutally tortured, and coerced into false confessions. Two-thirds of those accused were executed, according to historians. Unlike the United States, whose own shameful history of witch trials in Salem, Massachusetts, led to official exonerations and victim memorials, the Scottish government had never apologized for the atrocities committed against its own citizens, according to activists who have campaigned for a formal apology. That changed Tuesday when Nicola Sturgeon, the First Minister of Scotland, addressed Parliament and apologized for the persecution. "It was injustice on a colossal scale," said Sturgeon, who made the statement on International Women's Day as part of a speech that also called on Scottish leaders and the public to combat modern-day misogyny. Sturgeon extended a formal, posthumous apology to all those accused, convicted, vilified, or executed under the Witchcraft Act of 1563. Thank you for joining us for the Friday edition of the Denver Post. My name is Tammy.